Hello, you're listening to People, Pets, and Vets with Dr. Brad Miller and registered veterinary technician Angel Martin.
Hello, everyone.
Each week, we bring you current events and news in the veterinary industry and share our thoughts and perspective on how they impact us in our animal hospital. We also try to give an insight and behind-the-scenes glance at our clinic and the people who work in it. What's the name of the Frenchie Roman?
Oh, man. He melts my heart. Gosh. The dog downstairs.
Oh,
he's
I don't.
So cute.
Angel, you've been playing with him all day.
No, his name is Roman.
Oh, okay.
He's so adorable.
Little brown, slightly brindle, but not completely brindle.
I would call him fawn.
That is a good word right there. Yeah. Fawn. Yeah, I've seen that a lot.
Okay. Yeah. That's what you would call like a pug of that color, right? Mm. Like fawn with a black face.
He's more chocolate cinnamon than... He's not the fawn like a...
Little darker.
Mastiff or... Yeah.
Yeah, he's a little darker.
He's darker. But good gosh,
he is
cute.
So cute.
And he is so stupid. And, you know, he is so innocent.
Adorably
and,
cute.
I mean, he tried to walk through the glass pane on our storefront during the surgery today.
Oh, man. With a toy in his mouth.
And not only did he do it once, he did it again and again and again. And I'm just like, oh, my gosh.
To your point, it's just that, like, naive innocence, right? It's so funny.
So he is super cute. So we're happy to have him. But Dr. Yee, We talked before you came on board, and I know you have a lot of different interests, and maybe not, you're not just like super laser focused on any one thing, but kind of where are you at with that now? Are you just still kind of exploring, or have you kind of started to gravitate toward
one or the other? It's tough to say what my passion is versus what I'm comfortable with. I think my myxomatous mitral valve disease, like MMVD, that is like, I'm so comfortable with it, and I understand the disease so well and the medications and whatnot, so I can gravitate towards it and explain it easily. But is that my passion for it? I don't know. I love cardiology, but do I really want to, you know, manage the same case 90% of the time? I'm not sure. Whereas for surgery, I definitely like it. I like using my hands. I think it's intuitive, but it's also very just practical, you know, it makes sense. But at the same time, when I'm in there and I'm alone in that room and I have to figure something out, and, you know, there's that stress inside of me that's like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? Before I call for Dr. Miller to help me out, that's when, like, I'm not sure. Like, I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna have to do this, you know, I'm gonna eventually have to realize, like, what the problem is and be able to fix it and kind of things like that. I would say for the top two, those are probably my top two the things that I like most.
So, yeah, I mean, back to the surgery thing, you're right. I mean, you either like completely shut down or you try to figure it out, or you also know when to ask for help. And so, believe it or not, like today, I had a couple of moments of the same thing. Like, oh my gosh, what do I do? And this didn't go right. And I mean, you were involved in the last case of the day where we kind of said, oh, maybe we should have done this and realized that. So to me, that's super exciting because, you know, once again, it just, every case is different. But yet there's the whole comfort thing, right?
Yeah.
Like doing the spay, and I've done however many, you know, maybe I've done 1,000 spays, maybe I've done one, I don't know, but, you get into that routine, but yet you can't get super comfortable because you're going to have a curveball every once in a while, which once again, it keeps it exciting. Mm-hmm. So once again, very good answers from Dr. Yee, the communicator.
Do you think, so are you guys taught in school as far as like the weight that you carry in the practice? Did you ever imagine that like a lot of that responsibility, whether it be in surgery or in an exam room, that would come all back to you? Or like in school, are you like, oh, go to work for somebody and it will always be someone else that will carry the burden for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I had it kind of, had an internal conflict actually in the beginning when I first became like a official associate vet here. It's like, I love the part of talking to the client at school because I'm giving them the update on, you know, so-and-so Snoopy's doing so well in the morning. I break down the drugs that we're doing, break down what we're watching for, answer any questions. I can do that at night and it's amazing and I love that. But I think I didn't realize that you're not the driver, but you feel the benefits of the client communication, and you get to be there with Snoopy, and you're there for along the ride, but you're not the one responsible at the end of
the
day.
You're not ultimately, yeah.
Yes, and you're not making the final says and decisions and things like that. Whereas now it is very much like from the moment I walk in the room and I talk to the client, I realize like I bear a lot of the responsibility now.
Absolutely.
And I think one of the biggest takeaways I've had probably within the last couple months is at the end of the day, it's you're practicing veterinary medicine.
Exactly.
Because there is this high pressure of like, you don't want to mess up. Like whether it's surgery or medicine, this is someone's dog, this is someone's cat that they love. And we don't want to treat that like a trial run. You know, I don't want to just think that I have the right answer and go with it without asking someone older than me or someone more experienced. But at the same time, like, sometimes you just have to go with what you're feeling and what you know is right and have the confidence to kind of continue. And if you mess up, then you kind of make sure you correct your error, you correct your mindset and go back and do it again. So yeah, I feel like when it comes to practicing, that's kind of what I'm like, you're not always just one step away from falling off a cliff. That's how I always feel like if I do this rather than this, is this going to happen? Like, and it's just such a, it just kind of entangles you and kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it again, we talk about the rewards, but there's a lot of stress.
Mm-hmm.
And you want a little stress, but not too much, to where you're going home and worrying about everything you did and every patient you treated, you know, today and yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, responsibility, right? You are the doctor. It is your job to try to get this patient better.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, ultimately, you're human. And so you will make mistakes. I continue to make mistakes every day.
Mm-hmm.
And our clients are very demanding at times.
Mm.
But yet when you kind of develop that relationship with them and have these honest conversations and we all have the same goal and this is what I know and this is what mm-hmm. I see. You know, you gave me some history and here's what we're going to do. Do you agree with that? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's an extremely busy and exciting time in veterinary medicine. And I actually probably over the last 2, 3, 4 years, the more I learn, the less I know, I feel like. But
mm-hmm.
I just try to really communicate with the clients, and I will literally let them know, like, we are human. We do make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, if something goes wrong, just know that we're all trying to do the best thing to get your pet better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that kind of makes me feel better. And I kind of feel that way, like we've talked about, maybe the mental health issues in veterinary medicine, suicide issues, you know, that's not been talked about in the last 18 months, but, you know, the prior 18 months, that's been a big deal.
For sure.
And so, you know, at the end of the day, we're all doing the best we can. And if your client is so demanding and not understanding and involved in some of these decisions, mm-hmm. then do not beat yourself up. You're doing the best you can with the information given you and the staff around you, et cetera. At some point, you have to kind of draw the line mm-hmm. and realize what mm-hmm. you can and can't control. So mm-hmm. I feel like we've gone really serious.
Yeah, you got
it's
really
getting
deep
over here.
Dark, but that's part of it, right? I mean, we're hearing he loved being in the teaching hospital, loves the animal care, the people care, but ultimately he is a doctor on the case.
Mm-hmm.
You have support, you have consultants, you have mentors, you mm-hmm. have support staff. And so, yes, take it seriously. Don't just blow it off and say, oh, that's not my fault, but yet realize you're human. So, that, I mean, that's
for
kind
sure.
of
it's a balance.
Maybe fatherly advice or whatever you'd call it. But
I was just like more so, I guess, definitely I agree with you, right? Like I have been in this industry long enough that I've definitely seen people kind of take it a little bit too hard. But I don't know that they necessarily prepare you guys for that. Mm-hmm. And I say you guys is like the graduating classes, and I don't know that they ever did.
Mm-hmm.
Because how do you, right? Like how do you tell someone like your job is going to be stressful?
Be prepared
your
for this.
Your responsibilities are going to be immense, mm-hmm. you know?
And most people think it's all about like euthanasia, like, oh, it must be so hard to be a veterinarian to euthanize pets.
Yeah, we do hear that a lot.
But actually I'm like, no, it's actually a very good thing that we can do if we mm-hmm. do it at the right time.
Yeah.
You know, and so yes, we're emotional, but it's not that hard on me. But I do. It's like when a family member dies or a a friend's family member dies, you mm-hmm. feel very bad for them because mm-hmm. of the process they're going through, mm-hmm. but right. yet maybe you didn't have that relationship, but yet you feel bad. So it's kind of very mm-hmm. similar for yeah, euthanasia. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
So I did read one article today.
Okay.
Cannot quote the source, but it talked about preparing. Basically, veterinary education needs to change. We need to prepare these vet students that are coming out and becoming new associates to become clinical veterinarians once they get out mm-hmm. and actually justify the base pay that they are demanding and getting paid these days. And I thought that was kind of spot on. I don't know the answer, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but I kind of feel like maybe starting 10, 15 years ago when we got out of the routine, or fill in the blank with whatever word's appropriate, of operating on live animals mm-hmm. to teach our vet students how to do surgery. Mm. So we started getting air quotes or whatever you call that, rabbit ears, we did not agree with doing surgery on live animals because it was inhumane.
Because they were all terminal.
And they were terminal, mm-hmm. or maybe they were three and then terminal. And so we then went to these models. And so I don't know the answer once again, but, you know, the last couple of associates that I've hired, you being one, Dr. Seek being the other, mm-hmm. y'all are awesome, and you do have a ton of brain smarts, you know, skills, communication skills, and you actually have a lot of clinical skills as well. But I do know there are people that are recent graduates that have zero clinical skills. Mm. And so that is kind of a problem, I think.
Mm. Well, so let me get your opinion, Dr. Yee. So we talked about this last week, or last time we did a podcast, mm-hmm. in regards to the different styles of vet school. So okay. We also have a vet student here with us, Graham, which we've talked yeah. about on our podcast yeah, before. And so he's going to what I would consider more of a non-traditional vet school, in the mm-hmm. sense that they don't have a teaching hospital on site.
For sure.
So the vet clinic, or the vet hospital that we talked about that Texas Tech just opened, mm-hmm. they're boasting that it allows them to have cheaper rates for their students, so that they are going to get more attendees
yeah.
Because they don't have a teaching hospital, which granted teaching hospitals cost millions of dollars.
Yeah, very expensive.
And so, but as we talked, it's kind of like the tech schools that we see in this area. Those students really only get the experience, and they only become as good as the rotations
yeah,
that they go through.
Exactly.
So what are your thoughts? Mm-hmm. Do you have any opinions? Mm-hmm. If you had to do it all over again, do you think it would be a benefit to go to a vet school with a teaching hospital, or a benefit to go through multiple
courses? What would you recommend to the vet schools? Yeah. Because the next question I'm going to ask you is, what would you recommend to the vet student?
Mm. I see.
That's a recent, you know, entry into vet school.
Yeah. If I was to go back, actually to go before this, as far as like the curriculum goes with vet stuff, yeah, it's just, they do a great job preparing you in most ways, but it's so different, you know, like you get blood work that, you know, the teacher already knows, let's say it's a parvo case. So the blood work's all scripted, right?
Versus, it's like classic, right?
Exactly,
right out of the book.
Exactly. Versus if it's something that's kind of nebulous, something kind of throws you off in real life, because that's what it's going to be. There are going to be two parameters that you're just going to be like, how did these fit in with what is going on here? And that's when clinical kind of all that you really learned and cemented, it really shows whether that's there or not, versus like, oh, I mean, yes, we're in GI intestinal diseases, so we're learning about parvo, so this is what we'll find, you know. So there's definitely things that we learn, but I don't know if it's ever possible to overcome that learning curve of where you just have to get in it and you have to learn yourself.
We call that clinical reasoning.
Clinical reasoning, and I'm gonna kind of pop in here, and we talked about mentoring, right? Mm-hmm. So you wanted a lot of mentoring coming into the mm-hmm. practice. That was like going to be a deal breaker if we didn't do it. And we talked about it. It's going to, yes,
and
we're going to formally mentor you. We're going to sit down every Friday at 2:00 and we're going to meet for 4 hours, you know, whatever the case may mm-hmm. be. And I'm like, but just realize it's going to kind of happen as we go along.
Yeah, yeah.
And here we are. That's exactly what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Every day we're talking. I told somebody that I probably get 100 questions a day.
I agree.
And I'm all up for it. I'm for it. That's the best way to learn. Uh-huh. So.
Yeah, for sure. And that's huge, too. So that's advice to recent grads or even students. And then as far as going back to the teaching hospital debate, there is so much just a negative stigma around these non-traditional schools, like whether it's island schools or we talked about LMU, which is another one. But I don't. Honestly, because a lot of them do rotate through UGA, so I've seen a bunch of different students from two different years, so let's say at least 60 of them to get a decent sample size. I honestly feel like school is kind of not as dependent as much as just how much they're willing to put forth the work. There were some LMU students or, you know, island students that honestly, they were just slackers. Like, they didn't show up for treatments. They didn't carry the load they should have.
Did you see the same thing, though, at UGA?
Exactly. Yeah. So then, but I saw some excel to the point where they can easily assimilate into our class and be just fine.
Yeah.
So I really think it's just the amount of initiative, how much you study, whether it's that or whatever you need to do in school to thrive. I think that's what I realized. I'm like, school is... Yes, it's great if you can get into UGA or in some in-state institution because it's cheaper that way. But at the end of the day, I wouldn't label someone by that because it really just – it was really person-dependent at the end of the day.
I think that's super good assessment. It's the individual.
Yeah.
We have an individual that works for us that went to an island school. Mm-hmm. She's a great doctor.
We have a couple, actually.
Very true, yeah.
I'll have to think about that, but –
I ask them questions every day.
No, so I think that's super interesting. And one thing I think that, like, our I guess high schools aren't necessarily doing, in our middle schools even, for our students that are eventually going off to college, are teaching them how they learn, right? And so I think if you are a student going to college and or undergrad, or and then you have postgraduate or graduate and postgraduate mm-hmm. aspirations, right? Like, you really need to understand, like, how do you learn? Can you teach yourself? Is online programs, like, are they okay for you? Would you do better, like, having a teaching hospital and having this, like, group of people that you see every day and that you can communicate with? Or are you a little bit more, like, diverse and I want to see all these different things? So I would agree with you. I think it really is person-dependent. That's probably why those schools were created, right? Like, people that thrived better at those environments.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think we need to do a better job at teaching our younger people to really understand how they're learning and then apply that as they get older, you know, through, like...
In my vet school class, I had a guy, his name is Kelly. He was a guy. so he made horrible grades in undergrad. He did not get in the first time he applied to vet school, did not get in the second time, did get in the third time. I mean, he had like a 2.7 or so, somehow got in. He made a 4.0 throughout his entire vet school career.
Wow.
Because he applied himself and he knew what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so that's just kind of an inspirational story, but it exemplifies what we're talking about.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes. You know, Texas A&M, great vet school. Just because you go there doesn't mean you're a great vet.
Exactly. I mean, that's tough to say.
Yeah. C equals DVM, right?
And not always are the most academically inclined people the most clinical.
That's
either.
Another thing, yeah.
For
so
sure,
there's
I mean,
so
the
many
top
variables.
Of the class
of
graduate
this.
May
yeah.
not be the best clinician. So, okay, another story.
Okay.
In the news this past week was the fact that a lot more people are going back to work, and all these COVID puppies that they had and still have, hopefully. Now we're having to go to daycare. So there was a story, I think it was out of Washington State, maybe Seattle, and it kind of journaled this lady taking her doodle in the car to go to daycare, and you see these pictures, and then she drops it off at daycare, and she's so worried, but yet we see pictures of the doodle just flourishing and playing through the tunnel and the ball pit, etc. And then it kind of mentioned, but didn't really go into the fact, you know, the human factor. And so we've been talking about canine primarily separation anxiety and how that's going to be a big problem, and how these dogs are not going to deal with not being with their humans 23 out of 24 hours a day. But nobody's talking about what the humans are going to feel and how they're going to deal with it, because they went and bought these puppies to help get them through COVID, and now they're going back to work. They don't have their puppy, right? So they're probably going to want to look at their puppy on camera. They're going to want to talk to their puppy.
Yeah.
They're going to love their puppy when they get home more than they ever loved it.
Oh, my goodness.
They're probably going to be depressed when they're away from their puppy. We had a lady today on a dog that we took in at 7:30 this morning, and at 3 o'clock after the dog's procedure, she had to see a picture of her dog. She had to see it, had to see it. My comment was, well, good gosh, why didn't she take a picture this morning before the dog came in to look at her dog? But you know where I'm going. I mean, the connection there. But nobody is, like, acknowledging the fact that people are going to have that same separation anxiety, but hopefully they're not going to chew the door frame off or a hole in the drywall or destroy the couch like our dogs would do.
So argumentatively, Lou, I will say that I've seen a lot of articles, and I can't, like, necessarily pin one down, but there are a lot of companies that are continuing to offer at-home work. Right. So work from home options, or they are also, like, spacing out places in offices so you can bring your pets to work. There are a ton of places that are really allowing people to do that.
Yeah.
And I think it's good, but I also kind of think it's somewhat of a negative. We've talked about this before, right? Like, pets are not always meant to go with you everywhere. Mm-hmm. We've talked about, like, in years past or in podcasts past about, like, pets in heat exhaustion and that kind of thing in the car, and when they get stressed and all this kind of stuff.
For sure.
So they're not always meant to travel with us. But certainly there is a relationship, right, and companionship with pets. That's almost the whole reason why we have them.
Yeah.
So I think what you're talking about is hysterical in the sense that, like, the newspaper, I'm assuming, like, attributed this whole article to this lady taking her dog to daycare.
So I mean, you're thinking about, you know, the I'm going to say the new mom, but maybe just the mom who's dropping her two-year-old two-legged critter at daycare, or her six-year-old, you know, off to kindergarten.
Yeah.
That is super stressful for both parties. So, it was kind of crazy.
But I would say, like, if humans can do it, right? Like, five-year-olds do go to kindergarten and they survive. Your dog can probably do the same thing. But actually, going to doggy daycare where the dog is actually still socially involved is probably a good
thing for the dog.
Alternative, for staying at home.
Yeah.
I agree. We thought that was a good idea when we opened the practice back in 2003, and we just never had the staff, or really, I guess, the ultimate desire to do that. But I do think it's a good idea.
I think doggy daycare is a great idea, as long as I don't have to be involved in administering.
It is a lot of work. It is a lot of work.
How do you explain the little scrapple that...
It's exactly. A ton of work. I mean, we used to take our dachshund to doggy daycare when we first got him, when we lived in Michigan, long, long time ago.
So.
But yeah.
Okay, anything else you guys want to talk about? Or are we about ready to wrap it up?
I don't think so. What about you, Dr. Yi? Any weird questions you have for us?
Weird questions? No, actually.
Or random, like, normal questions.
Adding on to what you guys just talked about, did you guys hear of the movie called The Run?
No.
It's
called The Run, and it's this mom that she's trying to have a child, and her child dies due to a miscarriage, unfortunately, and she purposely steals another child, and she basically poisons this child for its whole life to believe that it's disabled. Because she believes that she needs to be there for the daughter to do well. And that's kind of the same mindset, I feel like.
So you're telling that story. I've not personally witnessed that story, but I've seen, like, movies and instances, you know, where women kidnap other babies. And so mental illness is definitely out there, unfortunately. Probably always has been, but now more common.
Yeah.
So.
It's kind of like COVID. We're instantly inundated with all that information, right? So, like, we hear it all the time.
Crazy. All right. Well, Angel, if you will sign us off, please. Thank you, Dr. Yi.
Of course.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. You were super involved, and I really appreciate that.
Oh, it was fun.
Yeah. Check in next week, guys, as we discuss more in the news and in our industry. Follow us on Instagram at People, Pets, and Vets. Make sure to check out our website at mygavet.com. You can get our podcast there under the resource tab. You can also check out our blogs, which I haven't checked lately, but I think our most protective dog breeds is still doing
pretty
well.
Still number one.
Yep.
Nationwide.
Then, Yeah. Lastly, guys, remember, without people, pets are simply animals.
Bye, guys.